Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Nikki Wells with us. She's the author of Sophie's Turn. She's born and raised in Germany, moved to the UK in 1993 in the United Kingdom. Having received 2 degrees, Nikki spent 6 years working as a researcher and a project manager for an international human resources research firm based in London and Washington, D.C. She left work in November 2004, spent 3 months writing her debut novel, Sophie's Turn, before the birth of her first baby in April 2005. And then since then, Nikki's had another child and qualified as a teaching assistant and is volunteering as such in her local primary school on a part-time basis. Nikki, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me. It's a great opportunity.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about Sophie's Turn, what is that?
Sophie's Turn is, as you said, is my debut novel. I call it a modern romantic fairy tale, rock star romance. I wrote it for me, primarily, as my all-time favorite book. But I also wrote it for all of us who've secretly dreamed about perhaps dating or marrying their favorite star, whether it's a rock star or a movie star or any kind of star, really. It's honest. It's very honest. It's charming. It's funny. And sometimes it will make you cry. It tells the story of Sophie Penhaligon, who suddenly one day finds herself engaged to a rock star, Dan Hunter. It's her every dream come true, and she's ecstatically happy about this, except that she's technically already engaged to Tim, her boyfriend of 2 years, and she just doesn't know what to do. She doesn't know how she got there, and she doesn't know what to do with herself. It's not an ideal situation, so my novel tells you what she does from there, how she got into this position, and what she does about it.
Do you find that there's a tremendous amount of women around the world, not necessarily getting involved with a rock star, but meet someone and they think it's the love of their life, and then one day they walk around the corner and they meet somebody else, and all of a sudden it's completely different? Do you think this is a scenario that a lot of women go through to some degree?
Do you know, one of my readers sent me a message saying, it's really spooky because this happened to me. She has a husband, she has children, and she suddenly met this person who she'd not seen since her high school. And I gather it was quite a challenge for her, and she suddenly started questioning everything about her. And she said it was really interesting to see Sophie's journey and compare it with her own experience. Needless to say, she's still with her husband. She's blissfully happy, but it did shake her up a bit, I think. So I think it will resonate with women in that kind of circumstance.
By the way, I think that the years I've been around authors, the one thing that I have found out that stays constant is that to be successful as an author, you have to be able to project a scenario that the readers actually begin to live. They resonate with it. They recognize it. And all of a sudden, it's them, and it's not, quote-unquote, somebody with a rock star, somebody with somebody else. And I really believe to get anything successful, it's got to resonate in such a way that they see themselves within the problem. Now, let me ask you this, and the many, many authors go through this, probably 99%, whether it's fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, there comes that time in the writing that you get this cathartic moment, this aha moment, where you realize something about the subject matter that you've never thought about before. Where was that for you? Where was the eye-opening awakening for you?
Do You know, that's a really good question, because I planned this novel meticulously. I had a complete flow chart with all the chapters, all the events, all the twists and turns, and I came to what I knew was going to be the critical scene, and I planned an ending, and I found Sophie didn't go there. She just didn't want to do it. She wasn't on my wavelength anymore. She was her own person, and she didn't agree with the ending I had written for her. I actually spent a few sleepless nights trying to work out what was going on. I can't give too much away because it will spoil the ending.
No, of course.
But it was a really, as you say, cathartic moment for me, because I got to this point and it all gone swimmingly, and we were all one happy little writing family, Sophie and Dan and me. And suddenly she threw this big spanner in the work, and it was a real eye-opening moment, because I didn't really know where this was coming from. You know, I was in charge of this book, and suddenly it was running away with me. And it came up with an ending that was actually much better than the one I had initially envisaged. And a lot of the readers have commented on the fact that they were really satisfied with the way she eventually takes the story to its conclusion.
Now, by the way, when we talk about conclusion, it's got to have that certain something that everybody recognizes within themselves. I've seen something similar, and especially around the Christmas holidays, it doesn't matter what religion somebody is, you know, that moment when family, you know, it represents families and opening up and love and so on and so forth. I think the timing for the book is probably really good. There's that window of opportunity that everybody wants to have a love affair now. And when I say a love affair, in their mind, emotionally, romance, quote unquote, it's in the air now. And I would venture to guess that with everything that's going on in the world today, and we don't have to get into that, you need to escape. You need to be able to get into that realm of dreams whereby there isn't anything that's impossible, because you know in the end result, no matter what happens, it's going to work out.
Absolutely.
Now, by the way, when
Where
you...
Do you want me to... I totally agree. Sophie's turn is meant to offer that kind of escape. I mean, it is in the UK, it's called chick lit. I don't know what you call it over in the United States, but I suspect this is a chick lit, a very big thing. And it's been accused of being pink and fluffy and escapist and somehow not worthy. But actually, I think it definitely has a space, especially in this environment. You know, everybody is struggling financially. Things are doom and gloom all over the place. And you need something to take you away, something to make you happy, something to buoy up your spirits a little bit and make you think, you know, life actually is wonderful and there is love and I can make this happen and I can go and have some fun. And that's what I wrote this book for. And it's totally unashamedly a romance that is meant to make you feel better.
Yeah, and when you really come down to it, when we look at the romance novels, men, women alike, everybody loves them, because we've gotten such a different definition of love and of romance and of all those things that we took for granted. You know, in the last, I would say, 25, 30, 35 years, the definitions have become different. You know, you see so many things out there that are causing a lot of pain. People resonate to it, and they're suffering. They don't want to see anything. And then every once in a while, you get this bright spark that brings you something, and I'm going to say timeless, because the plot and everything you're talking about, you can't put it into a time. Those of us who were around way back there would get to a point where they'll recognize that. Those people that are here now in the different cultures will recognize something that they've been missing, and maybe you could spark something in somebody to turn their life around.
So that will be a truly amazing outcome. If I ever heard a story, you know, coming back to me, I've read Sophie's Turn and loved it, and it inspired me to do something just slightly different with my life. That would be wonderful.
No, because what you're really saying is opportunities are still there. Choices are still there. Whatever choice she made and however she made the choice, there had to be a process to get to that choice. And I would venture to guess that everybody that was, I would say, not necessarily even women, men and women, I would venture to say that they're trying to help her out. You know, that this is, you know, this is what you want to do. And that gets total involvement, and that keeps somebody, quote unquote, on the end of their seat.
Absolutely. And as I said, I've had some people giving me reviews. I've conducted a blog too. I'm obviously trying to get this book to my readers. I'm an independent or self-published author, so I've gone out there. I've trawled the landscape, and I've got a lot of reviews out on these blogs. And quite a few have said to me, "Look, I couldn't put this book down. It had me hanging on my seat. I had to be dragged away from it. I just wanted to finish it. I was totally with her on that tour bus with that band, in all these places, and it's fantastic. And that makes me as an author just amazingly happy." It's the equivalent of seeing your child stand up in the nativity for the first time and sing, yeah. And you're just so proud.
Yeah, well, because when it really comes down to it, romance is universal. I don't care what country that you're in, it's universal. And the stories behind it is universal. And some cultures, obviously, it doesn't quite work that way, but for the most part, it does. And this is the time of year everybody's looking for that certain something, that gift, that whatever it is that they can resonate with and walk away from. Now, the question would be also this: is the book alive? And when I say is the book alive, if I pick the book up and if I read it page to page, cover to cover, if I read it again, would I see it in more depth and would I get more out of it?
I think so. And I say this for a very simple reason, which is I wrote it 6 years ago in 3 months, which is a very short time frame for a book that's about 140,000 words strong. It's quite a hefty tome, actually. And then I left it. And when I came back to it, I had obviously a lot of distance, about 2 or 3 years between writing it and going back to it and reading it again. And even me having written it, I found things that I'd forgotten or things that I perhaps interpreted in a different manner. And I think it is the kind of book you can go back to and read again and find another layer of meaning or another layer of jokes, find jokes that you didn't see the first time. It's a little bit like a movie that made you cry the first time round, and you see her building up to the decision. Well, I started crying because I knew what she was going to do and how she was going to do it, and it made me well up there and then. So I do think it's the kind of book that you could go back to and dive deeper and extract more from it.
Nikki, one more question. We're starting to run out of time now, but one more question. What is a rock star?
What is a rock star?
Yeah.
Well, now that depends entirely where you're coming from. Sophie's rock star is a man by the name of Dan. Now, when she first met Dan, his band was kind of medium big. They were having success. He was singing. He was songwriting. He had the long hair. He has the blue eyes. He's kind of... he's a cool dude, and he's just got that charm oozing out of them, a little rough around the edges. Yeah. When she meets him again, he's a mega rock star. I mean, he's known around the world, and girls just going after him left, right, and center. That's sort of, that's your John Bon Jovi or your Def Leppard. But then you might have a singer-songwriter in your neighborhood who rocks your world. He writes music that inspires you, that makes you happy, that makes you sing along, that makes you maybe pick up your own guitar. He may not be famous, but he's still your own very rock star. So I think it sort of depends on what ticks your boxes and what your context is and what you're after. Certainly the second type of rock star would be infinitely more reachable than the first type of rock star. But I think it's in the eye of the beholder. It's very much what you're looking for and what you find, really.
No, and I hear you loud and clear. Nikki, we're out of time. I just quick about a rock star. A rock star symbolically is beyond the reach of most people. They're not even real. I mean, they're physical, but it is such a far reach. And I think that's kind of interesting because it goes beyond what the possibility of a person's imagination could be.
And that takes me back to my opening comment. That's why I describe it as a modern romantic fairy tale. It's that idea of, the normal girl and the king, on the man and the princess, that kind of level of of remove, if you will, that level of aspiration. So you got a very good point there.
Nikki Wells, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at in the book?
I certainly have. I have a blog, which is a little bit of a mouthful. But if you, I think the address is on your website today. Or else, alternatively, if you search for Nikki Wells Clippert, that's K-L-I-P-P-E-R-T, it will bring up my blog. It's on WordPress. It's called Nikki's Blog. You can get Sophie's Turn on Amazon.com and .co.uk and actually all over Europe. Again, if you search for Sophie's Turn or Nikki Wells, it will pop up there. It will come to the Kindle straight away. It is available now for download. And it's actually, if I may say so, it's not out of the domain of the show. I'm running a little bit of a Christmas sale at the moment. At that moment, Galen. So that's sort of all I have to say.
Nikki Wells, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated it. Sounds like a wonderful book. Everybody should buy it.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Michael, for having me on the show. It's been a fantastic opportunity. I've really enjoyed myself.
Good night.
Good night.
Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Arthur Wiley with us. He's the author of Only the Crazy and Fearless Win Big, The Surprising Secrets to Success in Business and in Life. He's internationally regarded as an investing and entertainment mogul, Arthur Wiley. Again, he's the author of the only Crazy and the Fearless Win Big, The Surprising Secrets to Success in Business and in Life. He serves as the CEO of Arthur Wiley Enterprises, a brand with diverse practice areas, including business consulting, real estate, investing, speaking, entertainment, film production, book publishing, and philanthropy. And let's say hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me. How are you?
Arthur, yeah, I'm fine. Thank you for being here. You know, you're right. It's only the crazy and the fearless win big. And when it comes down to it, the negotiating is an art. It's not something that somebody just knows how to do. It's a step-by-step process, and if you've got it down, you win.
Absolutely. I mean, negotiation is important. It's the ability to work through other people to get the things that you want, but it's something that can be definitely fun. But if you don't do it well, you won't do well in business, and sometimes you won't do well in life. If you do it well, it can really change your outcome and some of the goals and things that you're trying to achieve. So I definitely agree.
Now, by the way, what your first key is know your value. I wonder how many people really get involved in negotiation and don't really know, Arthur, they don't know what their real value is. They don't truly know what they have to offer. And in the end result, they lose because they could have got more.
You know, you're right, Michael. In closing, you know, several deals with multimillion-dollar fund companies and entertainment companies, it's always the small things that you have to convey to the other party. You have to know your value. You have to know your product and what you're trying to say. You got to be a specialist at it. You got to understand it. You know, people sometimes are excited to me. They think I have $400 million walking around in my pocket, and when they come to me, that I'm just going to give it to them because they have a potential inclination of what they want to do. But you have to really be firm and understand what your vision is, something that's very clear, know where you want to go. So you must understand what your value is.
No, absolutely. And I think value also comes with branding, and most people do not know how to brand themselves. It's that value proposition, Arthur. It's the why you're different, why they should buy from you instead of your competition. One of the things, then the key number two, I think, is really important with personal relationships. You and I can sit down and I can negotiate all day long and tell you how wonderful I am. But it's the people around me. It's the interaction with the staff, the crew, the people that I'm involved with that's really going to tell you about me, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even when I ran Arthur Wiley Wealth Management Group, one of the biggest things is that people did not invest into a mutual fund. They invested in me. They invest into Oppenheimer funds, Delaware funds, but they looked at the relationship that I had with them. Did I really, was I sincerely concerned about their well-being and their families? You know, and you have to look at that. You have to find commonalities amongst people to have a deeper understanding of their background so you understand what their needs are. So whenever you're doing a deal, don't always look at what you're getting out of the deal, but how can you help them achieve their goal? It's a very critical point. People that come here just want to blast straight through the door and say, listen, this is what I want to do. I'm going to change the life of your company. I'm going to do this, this, this. But it's all an agenda that's only for their benefit. You have to, you know, old adage, you know, you have to put your, you know, your feet in their shoes.
Now, by the way, one of the things you do address, and it's critically important, it's that old proverbial, the WIIF, what's in it for me. And what I have found over all of the years that I have been in business, communication, whatever the case may be, that when it comes down to it, my absolute favorite subject is me as an audience. And if you're talking to me, then I'm going to listen to you. And I really believe that that person on the other side of the desk has to hear the what's in it for me. Because if I don't recognize myself within what you're saying, it's going to go right over my head.
You know, not only that, what's in it for me, you also have to understand when you're doing a you know, major deal making, a multi-million dollar deal, is, you know, what are the reasons why they're going to say no? What is going to be the biggest objection? You have to understand that. And then once you understand what the biggest objections are, now you can go against that and start formulating the things that you need to say to actually win them over to your side to show that, look, listen, that you've actually looked at what they need. You value what their product, their service are, where their goals and accomplishments that they're trying to achieve.
Now, also, when you're really dealing with that, the life is more of a mirror than anything else. And when you're negotiating with something or they're negotiating with you, I'm going to go back to the recognition again. They're going to see if they can see themselves within you. If there's that spot of recognition of commonality that there can be collaboration with, that you can work together and move, that's one of the things that causes that step to get to, quote unquote, that call to action to get something done.
Oh, I agree. I mean, people do business with people they feel comfortable with, period.
Yeah.
I mean, if they don't feel comfortable with you, they will not do business. They can have, you can have the best product, you can have the best service that's out there, but if they don't feel comfortable with you, they're not doing the business.
No, absolutely. And then one of the other things is humility is so powerfully important, the be humble that you talk about. Because when it really comes down to, if I'm going to sit down all day and tell you how wonderful I am, you're going to lose interest after a while. So humility is a very powerful tool.
You know, when when I went to Hollywood, I started in the wealth management, and we managed a little bit over $500 million. And then one day I stepped to my president of our company, and I said, listen, we're walking around the pond. I said, James, I want you to sell one of our companies and all the assets on it. And he was just so surprised and shocked. He said, what are we going to do? And I said, well, I want to go into the entertainment and film industry because we just acquired the film rights from the Omar Tyree catalog. He's a New York Times bestselling author. And going into Hollywood, I've been so successful at other things. I said, well, how can I be successful in this business? Well, you can't go there and you know, with the big chip on your shoulder and say, listen, I was successful in this business. Give me all the business. I know what I'm doing. I'm the man. It's impossible. You have to look at being humble. And a couple of things you have to do when you go, when you look at being humble and you have other people that want to do business with you, it's always wise to ask questions. Ask questions about what they're trying to do. You know, it sounds something as simple as it is, but it's as simple as just asking questions of where they're trying to go and how you can actually get there.
I think most importantly, when you're dealing with that, and if you come in with your expertise, it's called ask the right questions. There's where the problem is most of the time. Arthur, people ask the wrong questions. They get the right answers for the wrong questions and never get anywhere. I think it's learning how to ask the right questions to really get what you're looking for. You know, you were talking about overcoming objections. Well, there's that quote-unquote, that hidden objection, the one that's there that if you don't ask questions and you don't bring it to the surface, you're never going to be able to address it. And if you don't address it, you've got yourself, you got a failure going in and you're going to have a failure going out.
You're absolutely right. And that goes back to if they really was going back to, you know, that second point you pointed out, the personal relationship, if they went back and really talked to those guys and found out what they were trying to do and their goals and find those commonalities, they'll have a much better opportunity to find out what those commonalities are to ask those type of questions that are deeper meaning and understanding. And you know, of course, everybody likes compliments. I mean, if you're going to be humble, compliment a person about their industry, you know, of where they are. Because obviously if they're successful, that's the reason why you want to talk to them and do business with them. So compliment them. You know, find out what it was that made them successful. And that also helps spur those other questions that you may want to ask in a deeper meaning to really help them become even more successful and also yourself in the process while you're doing successful deal-making.
Now, by the way, Arthur, in today's world, this is very critical to have this kind of information because it's a highly competitive world out there, and it's not necessarily even competition for money. It's competition for that sustainability to be able to be in business and keep on doing business where when the world is kind of falling apart right now, which it basically is. It'll come back together, but we're going through some rough times right now. So we're really talking about a process. We're talking about a strategy. And if you got the strategy down, this puts you up on a level playing field with those people who maybe before you couldn't compete with.
Well, you know, right now you're going to have the confidence to go out there. I mean, people, morale is very low with the way that the economy is, but you have to believe in yourself in what you're doing in your deal making. And you're only going to be able to do that again if you research, you understand what your value is, you understand what your product is. You understand what the other parties, things that they're trying to do and accomplish. But, you know, more importantly, with that confidence, it levels the playing field. If you don't have the confidence out there, they may not believe that you can actually pull it off. So you can never, you know, show that form of weakness because, you know, sort of like, you know, you have blood in the water, the sharks are going to end up coming. They're going to eat you alive. So you got to have a little swagger in your approach. You know, that's what I call it anyway, but it's where you have the ability to convey confidence without arrogance.
Yeah, now, by the way, you mentioned something a few minutes ago, I think it's critically important, is most people going in don't really know what it is that they want going in. And if you don't know what it is that you want going in, Arthur, you're not going to get it. So it's really honing down, you know, what is it that you want that I'll call an audience, one person, 15,000, it's all the same thing. You've got to be able to hone down what it is that you want that person to know and what you want them to do. If you have those two things honed down, peeled down, and you know exactly what it is, you stay on track, you stay focused no matter what comes up. If you don't know, which most people don't, you're going to walk away, and right. at the end of the day, you're going to be disappointed with the results.
Yeah, and a springboard on that. You have to know the beginning and also the end of a deal. You can't just know the beginning of it, and you can't just know the end of it. Either way, you're not going to you're going to have limited success. So you have to understand what the beginning and the end is going to be, the steps, the process. You know, whenever I look at any deal, I always look at what I want in the short term, what I'm trying to accomplish in the midterm, and what I'm trying to do in the long term. I was just putting together the Arthur Wiley Foundation, and we had our first board meeting tonight. And, you know, so many goals, so many visions, and so many things that we can do, so many people we can help. But how do you hone that down? What are we going to do over the first year? This is what our goal is. Okay, what is the next step over the next 5 years? You know, and we, I don't want to go into detail about the foundation because that's not what the show is about. But, you know, you get the idea. You have to know what the beginning, the end, and also have some type of legacy plan in any deal, any business, or any goal, or any plan that you're doing in life. So it's not just business. This is also things that you're doing personally as well.
Yeah, now, by the way, you bring up an interesting point. This could be in a one-to-one relationship. The rules of the game are the exact same thing. It's called learning how to deal with life, maneuver through, and come out ahead in the end result.
Oh, absolutely. I remember, and like again, I always have a lot of money management things because of running Arthur Wiley Wealth Management Group. But in the short term, it could be as simple as, you know, the first year of family, was their goal was to save $5,000. So they was putting $200-$300 away a month. You know, their midterm goal was to buy a house. So then they had certain goals that they were putting together to do that. And then in the long term, they wanted to retire in their 40s or 50s or, you know, or 60s, whatever the case may be. But there was a beginning and an end and a reason for what they were doing. So when you're in deal making, there's particular reasons why, if you have the game plan of what you're trying to do, you'll know what elements and ingredients to put inside of that plan or what to put inside of that negotiation to get to that final result.
Arthur, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website that we can find you at and buy the book?
Absolutely. Crazyandfearless.com. Crazyandfearless.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Arthur, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I've appreciated your time. And more people need to know that life and business is a step-by-step-by-step process. If you don't have the steps down, you're going to fall down.
Thank you, Michael. Appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Good night.
Missing me, baby. Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're going to miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. Gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you know, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby. For you.
Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so strange.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jackie Lappin with us, the author of Practical Conscious Creation, Daily Techniques to Manifest Your Desires. She's the world leader in educating, mentoring, and coaching people in practical conscious creation. And then her newest book, again, Practical Conscious Creation, Daily Techniques to Manifest Your Desires, answers the question, what do I do now? Jackie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's nice to be here. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, what a question. You know, when you think about that, I'll bet 130% of everybody twice a day probably says, what do I do now?
Well, and the real question is, what do I do now that I have some grasp of law of attraction, which is what many people do, and they kind of don't know what to do with it because they're not living the life of their dreams, and there are tools out there to help them, and that's what practical conscious creation is.
Now, by the way, when the law of attraction, when that first started and they sold all those books and they made the movies and they did everything they did and they made all the money doing it, the one thing that they didn't do, Jackie, and you hit it, they didn't tell anybody how to do it.
That's right. And that's what I do, is connect the dots for people to explain to them how this works and why, if they tried to do it after The Secret, it didn't work for them.
Yeah. And by the way, if somebody doesn't think the law of attraction works, let's say it this way. If somebody's got a really miserable life, if somebody keeps getting turned down all the time in a relationship, if somebody keeps losing a job, guess what? You attracted it some way, shape, or form. You created that to prove to yourself that you weren't worth having the things we just talked about. So it works. All you have to do is reverse it. And if it can get you in that kind of a mess, look what can happen if you find out how to change it.
Well, here's how you do that. The first thing is you really have to understand how the energy works. All of our bodies are obviously physical energy, but our emotions and our thoughts are just as much energy. And they go out into the world and they do one of two things. They either connect with things in a domino effect, or they attract like energy back to us, which is what like the law of attraction is. But we're vibrating in an entire scale of frequency. And at the low end of the scale, we're putting out fear and anxiety and worry and disappointment and distrust and anger. And when we're putting those frequencies out into the world, that is what we're unconsciously attracting back to us. And when we're doing that, that's when life gets very difficult. That's when we have money problems and relationship issues and our jobs are really unsatisfactory. And I call that driving the car with the brakes on. However, if you're vibrating in the high range, which is love and compassion, joy, peace, gratitude, and trust in the universe, then you're vibrating at the level that the universe vibrates at, which is the level of love. And the universe is actually carrying you along. It's like having the wind in your sails, or you're being drafted by a race car. And what happens is that the doors begin to open, life gets easy, synchronicities occur, and when you're consciously creating at this level, that is when thing you begin to manifest very quickly. And the reason that many people did not experience success after trying it after The Secret is because they were still vibrating all this low-frequency energy. And so essentially the universe is getting your high-frequency intentions, but your low-frequency is countermanding what it is that you really want to do. If you're desperate and angry and frustrated and because it's not gotten here, you're living in lack and worry, then you're not going to achieve it. If you raise your personal frequency, which is choosing to vibrate positive energy and knowing that all is well and that everything is on a positive path and that you, in fact, are a powerful human being, then if you're vibrating at that level, then, in fact, things begin to manifest.
You know, there's a different way to say that. Let's try it this way. That I'm in a nightclub and I'm not really feeling too great. I see you across the room. They got some really great music going on. So I wander over there and I ask you to dance and we get caught up in the music and the dance. My vibration changes. Now all of a sudden I'm in the mood of whatever that is, romance, whatever the case may be. And it is, it's a vibrational change. The music caused it in me when we started to dance. And it's the same thing in life. It's catching up to that vibration and allowing it to be, recognizing it, and becoming a part of it.
Well, and there are things that we can do to specifically to shift that vibration within ourselves. My first book, The Art of Conscious Creation, has 25 guiding universal principles on how to do that. But there are some simple ways that we can do it. You hit on one of them. Music is a good way to do it. But there's also things like, well, I have 250 roses. I literally go out and smell my roses, you know. But then there's, you know, you can work out. You can get out in nature. You can play with your kids, play with your pets, do meditation. Put yourself in a state where you have a memory of something beautiful that you live with. You can go out and serve others. Any of those things will shift your vibration instantly. But more importantly, I think we have to become aware of what we are vibrating. And the negative vibrations that we are doing, which I call negative energy habits, those things are complaining and worrying and obsessing and living in the past, you know, the kinds of habitual things that we do. And when you spot them and you realize that you're doing this on a regular basis, you can say, I'm not going there anymore. I'm going to think of this, I'm going to look at this differently. And my book, Practical Conscious Creation, is filled with 70 little individual articles over all aspects of your life, things like trust and expansion, wealth and prosperity, conscious living, compassion and love, romance and relationships, business and health, so many different areas that impact our life, and how you can raise your frequency through these individual little practical steps.
Okay, now the practical steps, very important. Let me hold you up just for a moment. Most people go through life, they don't know that there's choices and options available beyond what they've been exposed to before. So you take something like what you have, and the choices and options are there. When they recognize something that, let's call it the blind spot, they didn't realize was there before, and they can use it. I think it's that simple when it really comes down to it. Recognizing something that you didn't know existed that can change your life.
That's exactly right. And becoming aware of your frequency is the most important thing that you can do. Because when you know that you're doing this, you know you're responsible for what you're attracting and experiencing in your life, you become wonderfully empowered, and you then shift so that you are no longer a victim.
And it's interesting when you say no longer a victim. Let's add something to that. We'll springboard on that. You're no longer a victim of yourself.
That's very true, very true. Yeah. Because you realize that, for me, for when I am in a funk, I now take responsibility. And I think, if I don't get out of this right now, tomorrow is not going to be any fun. Or I'll come in with a ball of anxiety in my stomach, and my computer will go out. And there's no mystery in that. Our energy affects everything. So I now have to be conscious and say, I'm going to handle this differently. I have an article, one of the articles in here is called The Magic of Changing Your Perspective. How I can look at something that most people are initially, I would think, is a negative and say, no, I'm going to look at that differently. What did I learn from this? What did I learn that I can serve others? What is the gift in this for me? What am I being redirected to do? Another article in here, which is really fun, is it's a universal redirect. When we experience things that we consider mistakes, problems, obstacles, they're really none of those things. They're what I call a universal redirect. The universe is giving you an opportunity to go in a different direction, and it's clearly telling you the one you're working in now is not the right one.
Jackie, let me give you a prime example of that, and I've told the story once or twice on the air, but it's so perfect right now. I know somebody who wanted to be a professional athlete, and she just, you know, she did everything she could do, and she had a coach she was working with, and the coach said to her, you're never going to make it. You don't have what it takes. But she's one of these kind of women that you don't say no to. So she went out and she found another coach. She went on to succeed. She became a personal athlete. And she's now a professor at one of the universities, I think in California. And she's teaching athletics, etc. Now let's go back with this story. The guy who said to her, you can't do it, that she wouldn't listen to, she went out and found another one. She married him.
She found somebody of her vibration.
Absolutely. And if this guy hadn't have said to her, you can't do it, she would have never met her husband in the last 20 years.
Well, you know, and there's one of the fun articles I have in here. It's how to stay positive with a negative energy spouse. Because a lot of times you're actually married to somebody like that. And the really important thing is learning how to keep your frequency up. So that one, you can stay on your own path. Two, you change the dynamics in the relationship, because when you start changing and handling things differently, they have to. Three, they may look at you and say, wow, I like what she's going through. I want more of that. Remember when Harry met Sally? I want what she's having.
Yeah. No, I got it. That was great. Yeah, and absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the sad thing is that sometimes we have to release the people that do not join us as we raise our frequency.
Yeah.
And we have to let them go, because they're not healthy for us any longer. If we can't, if our high vibrations cannot influence and inspire them to their own growth, then it's time we move on.
You know, the other thing about doing that's very interesting, that I have found over a period of years, that if you take a step up in your emotions in your life and you feel better about yourself, the friends that you have at that moment drift away, because now you don't have anything in common. You can't get on the phone and say, you know, how horrible I feel, and you feel that way, but I feel worse than you do, and somebody beat me up, and yada, yada. They kind of just drift away. And one of the decisions that someone's going to have to make when they decide to do something like this is they're going to step into a whole new realm with many different people that they haven't been exposed to before. Because like draws like, and you will find the people who will justify how you feel about yourself.
Well, you know, and what's really nice about this is when you know how practical conscious creation works, as in my case, as I realized that the old folks in my life didn't really satisfy my need any longer, I chose to set an intention to attract new positive people into my life that were traveling the same path that I was. And they just started flooding in.
Yeah.
Because I have become a real manifester at this point. I recognize how to do this.
Yeah, and you don't have to look for it. It'll just happen.
No, one of my favorite, here are a couple of stories that I love that really occurred to me. I really wanted to share my beautiful roses with my community, and I didn't, and I really wanted to put my house on this, our garden tour locally, and I didn't know anybody, and so I just put it out to the universe, and a lady is walking by about 2 weeks later, and she sniffs my roses, and she says, gee, would you like to put your house on the Westlake Garden Tour? And then another time, a girlfriend said to me, I said to the universe, I would like a free vacation this year. A little tight on money, bring me a free vacation. Month later, a girlfriend calls and said, we just built a house in the Bahamas. Would you like to come and stay?
Yeah. No, I hear it loud and clear.
But you also have to be able to accept it. Yes.
Yeah. No, I know. I think it's great. Let's take you all the way back. What was it, Jackie, that triggered you? What was it that caused you to think the way that you think and do all of the things that you do now?
Well, you first have to understand that I was a conscious creator from the time I was 11 years old. I wanted to be a sports writer, and I told my parents I was going to be a sports writer. And there were no women sports writers. And I saw myself in press box working with the players and writing on the front pages of the stories. At 20, I was at the Associated Press. I mean, at the Detroit Free Press. At 21, I was at the Associated Press. And 22, I was at the Washington Post and writing for the front pages of the LA Times. So I was doing this even though I didn't understand the mechanism very, very early on. I went on to be very successful in the media relations world. I launched the first Farley Marathons. I had the National Hockey League as a client, the Golf Channel I launched. And the thing that you would probably most know me for over the last few years, I launched the worldwide poker phenomenon with the World Poker Tour.
Oh, yeah. How's this? I'll bet on
fun.
That.
So, Michael, what I really did was I started through a spiritual journey at about, 5 years ago to sort of understand why I wasn't as happy as I was and not where I wanted to be. And so I started reading all of the literature in the spiritual world, and I realized that there was a thread that was going through here. Mind you, this was before The Secret came out, that really was only touched on, and that was how our personal energy impacts our future. And that, out of that understanding came the first book, The Art of Conscious Creation. And that's when I started looking at how I could change my life. And I have to tell you, I am naturally not a glass half full person. I am a glass half empty. I had to teach myself this, and I'm still always a work in progress. But if I can learn this, then anybody can learn this.
Yeah, but you see, you're aware of it. I think that's 90% of the battle. It's the awareness. Most people walk around through life unaware, and not unaware that they're living. It's just not aware of all of the things and the opportunities that are there and available if they'll just look and open up. And most of the time, you don't have to, I take it back, you don't even have to look for it. If you're ready for it, it'll appear in some way, shape, or form.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And some of the things are that you really need to understand the power of visualization, too. And you've heard some of this about The Secret, but there's a couple of steps here that are really important. When you're visualizing what it is that you want to have happen, you have to do it in real time as if it was already happening to you, but you also have to have the emotional component with it. Because, you see, you have to feel what it is that you would be feeling, the joy, the wonder, the love, the abundance, you know, the freedom, because it's our emotions are the express mail to the cosmic post office. It's what the universe really responds to. So we have to do that. And then the next step, after we understand how and raise our frequency, consciously create with a visualization that is with great clarity what it is that we want to have happen. I heard you talking about that in your previous interview. And then you have to become an actionary. You have to actually take action. Because most people think that the universe is out to get them. But the truth of the matter is the universe conspires in our behalf. And when we actually start to take action, then things line up in our favor. That's when doors open and we're guided on a certain path or, the way becomes clear, money becomes available. You have to take the first step and then you're rewarded by the universe.
And as long as Mercury is not in retrograde, we're good.
Tell my computer about that.
it finished yesterday, thank you, knock on wood. I got it loud and clear. Jackie, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and the book and all the things you're doing?
Okay, go to JackieLapin.com, JackieLapin, or PracticalConsciousCreation.com. There is a very cool money tree download there and a video tip. And the download is something you want to get that is going to help you raise your frequency and focus no longer on lack. You're going to focus on your abundance instead and your abundant ability to create money and other things. You can find me there. You can kind of like me on Facebook, and you can find my book on my website and, of course, at Amazon as well.
Jackie Lapin, hey, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time.
It was lovely to be here, Michael. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
If you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone, that's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night, that's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. If I can fight with the cat here. Where are we? Tell that cat to go away. Go away, cat. Eldonna Lewis Fernandez with us. And she's known as the pink biker chick. And don't let the pink fool you. Deployed in the Middle East after 9/11 and retired from active duty as a contract negotiator in the Air Force in 2003. And after 23 years of honorable service, retired Master Sergeant Eldonna Lewis Fernandez is a force to be reckoned with. Trained to survey every room she enters and keep her back to the wall, she reveals the impact of stress and trauma in combating faulty decision-making as she trains women how to rethink, redirect, and energize for higher performance, better bottom line professional and personal decisions. Eldonna, hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. This word fear is a very interesting word. When did you overcome yours? Now, obviously, everything that you've been through, you know, there's a training that went with it. There's a process that you had to go, and it had to become a natural, instinctive part of you. But it had to start someplace. It had to be somewhere where you had to look something in the face and say, I'm done with this. I'm moving beyond.
Well, it was even after I got out of the military. I have what I call a mirror experience where I looked in the mirror and I realized the problem was staring back at me. And it was only up to me to do something to change my life. And I had a lot of fears in my life. And sometimes fear still attempts to come in, but I've done enough work and have enough tools that I can counteract it.
Yeah, but fear in and of itself, and this is what I've learned over all the years, fear doesn't come externally, it comes internally. And I really believe, and once we get that balance of where it comes from, that doesn't mean that I don't go through life, you know, something's going to frighten me, I'm a human being. But for the most part, no anymore, because I began to realize that it was coming from the inside, and I was the one creating the fear.
Definitely, and fear, a lot of fear has to do with your self-confidence about whatever you're fearful about. One of the fears that most people have that's even a fear over death is fear of speaking in front of people, even speaking on an interview like this, or speaking in front of a TV camera. It's a huge fear that people have because they feel inside, oh my gosh, somebody's going to look at me, I'm not confident enough, I don't think I know my stuff enough. It's something that they've created in their head. It's the self-talk that they have going and that tape that they push play on that keeps going over and over and brings up that fear and makes them want to turn and run the other direction.
You know, I had this fear following me for years. I'll never forget this. And when I finally found out where it was coming from, it was very interesting. If I got into a room that was kind of dark and if I'd be going up the stairs, I could feel it behind me. And I'd look around and there was never anything there. And that lasted for years and years. And one day, I was walking up the stairs and I felt it again. And it was very interesting. I just kind of relaxed into it. And it wasn't coming from behind me. It was coming from the inside of my head. And it was a cathartic moment. And I really got it that it wasn't anything outside. It was me. And things turned right around. I walk into dark rooms now. But that's where the key is when we begin to realize through behavior, something we've learned, something we've been taught, that this fear, it allows us not to go ahead and do things, and it's a great excuse.
Right, and it all ties back to thoughts. Thoughts are things, and the things that we have thoughts about is where we create those fears in our mind. And a lot of them are just made-up things that we've perceived, perceptions, maybe things we've grown up with. Sometimes if you're a child and maybe somebody scared you, you carried that fear with you because of whatever somebody did to you. But it's something that you carry inside of you. It's a thought process that you have about whatever particular thing that you're afraid of. You've made it up in your head to be afraid of it, so when you come up against it, then you feel that fear. You feel that feeling in the back of your head or in your gut or in your heart or wherever you feel it. And right at that moment, you don't really know where it comes from. But it's like what you did, it was perfect. You took a minute, you breathed, you got a grip on what it was, and you realize, oh, wow, this is just me. This isn't anything external of me. This is just me, and I can do something about it. And the second that somebody realizes that they can do something about their fear or whatever their thought process is, negative self-talk or anything along those lines, the second that you realize that it's completely down to you, that you have the control to do something about it, that opens up so many doors and things change for your life instantly.
Now, by the way, you're the founder and CEO of a seminar training company, Dynamic Vision International, and the creator and editor-in-chief of Go Pink Magazine. That's the online magazine for women who are motorcycle enthusiasts. And you've got the Go Pink Magazine as a vehicle to, and you say, empower success. The pink carpet interviews, you know, and when you deal with that. Where was it when you decided to start all this? When was that?
It was along the path of my own journey in healing and changing my life. I had some traumatic things happen to me over my life. I was raised by two alcoholic parents, and I made a lot of bad choices in relationships and had some abusive sexual harassment happened to me while I was on active duty. And I had that moment where I realized I'm going to change my life. And as I started to change myself and heal, I realized that I had a passion to really reach out and help people. And I'm very creative and very out-of-the-box thinker, so I started thinking, well, how can I do something? What do I really love? And I love motorcycling. Well, what does that have to do with people? How can I use motorcycling as an analogy to help people empower and change their lives? Well, I talk about taking control of the handlebars of your life, going from the back seat to the front seat, rolling on your throttle to accelerate towards success. So that was the foundation where I built it from, and I just started building from there, and Go Pink Magazine came out of that as a way for me to show women that it doesn't matter what size you are, you can ride a motorcycle no matter what. And that's another fear that a lot of women have, is learning to ride a motorcycle.
Oh, no question about it. I have to stop for a moment and tell you about Hilda the Hog, okay? Radio Susie's over there laughing at me. Hilda the Hog was a 1967 shovelhead. It was extended 18 over, and it had a molded square frame. That was my baby, and that was in the early to the mid to late 70s around the Los Angeles area. So been there, done that, loved every minute of it.
Oh, awesome. Well, you need to get back on a bike then.
That was great. Now, I haven't been on a bike probably for about 10, 15 years now. I think the last one I got on was a Harley Sportster. But there is a freedom of it, and you're absolutely right. When you're on that bike and you got your hands up on the handlebars and you're the one in control of the speed, life is like that too. You know, and if we really get that, we're the ones in control of the speed of our life and where our life is going to end up. And from what I'm listening to you say, doesn't really matter if it's a man or a woman. It's the same advice for everybody. It's called get in control of it and realize that you're the power behind it all.
Well, think about if you've ever ridden on the back of a motorcycle or even sitting in the back seat of a car. Think of your view from the back seat. Your view is blocked. You're not in control. Somebody else is doing the steering. You have no choice of where you're going to go or how you're going to get there because somebody else is in control. And a lot of times we give the handlebars of life to somebody else to steer and control our lives, and we're not in control at all. So the whole analogy from going from the back seat to the front seat of the bike and in your own life, grabbing those handlebars, then you have control of your life. You're steering where you're going, and you can have control over the fears that come that are confronting you.
You know, by the way, there's another analogy that works also, and this one's yours. This one you can have. It's also, and I heard this, you know, probably 30 years ago now. Most people put their hands on the rear view mirror and they steer down the highway of life and they get into a lot of accidents and they don't know why. But that very simple shift in thinking when you take your hands away from the rear view mirror and stop looking at the past and put your hands on the steering wheel and move forward with your life. And I think a lot of people do that. They take a step forward, but they're looking in the past, and they go through the same mistakes and the same fear and the same problems.
Well, a lot of people actually live in the past. You're existing and breathing in today, but your head is in the past. Oh, my gosh, I did this, I did that. I've made so many mistakes. I've made so many bad choices. Oh, if I could just redo this, if I could just have different parents, different family members, different anything, if I could just go back and change that, things would be better today, woe is me. Well, you're forgetting where you are today. You're living in today. Stop living in yesterday. You can't do anything to change yesterday. That's the whole rearview mirror analogy. People are always looking backwards and thinking, oh, gosh, what have I done? What could I have done better? Let that go. You can't do anything about that. What you can do something about is today. You can make it different today so your tomorrow will be just as bright.
You know, by the way, blame, it comes up also. It's great to blame somebody. Okay, it's all their fault that you're like the way you are. So now you've blamed them and they accept the blame. So what? You're still the way you are. So blame really doesn't get you a whole lot. And maybe you can assign, you know, the problem to somebody. But at the same time, so you've blamed them, and it doesn't get you anywhere. And you're still doing the same stuff. I think that it's time that most people just took a look in the mirror and decide, what do you want out of your life? Do you want it to go forward? Do you want to have a decent life? Or do you want to stay the way you are and be emotionally upset? And if you decide to do that, then do it well. Do it well.
Exactly. One of my Go Pink rules of engagement is release all resentment. And what I say is resentment is the poison that we take that we think kills others, but it really kills our spirit. I use the analogy, the example of my mother. My mother died of alcoholism when I was 12. I'm a few years older than that now, but I carried that resentment for so many years. And who's it hurting? I'm not hurting her. She's dead.
Yeah.
People will hang on to that blame. They play the blame, shame, and justify game where, oh, these people did this horrible thing to me, and that's why I'm the way I am, and I can never get past it or never do anything good because I had a horrible childhood or I was abused or I was beaten up. 85% of us grew up in some form of dysfunction. But if we keep living in that dysfunction by choosing the same type of people that created that kind of dynamic, we'll stay there. We can have a choice to let go of the past, push past the past, take control of the handlebars of our life, get past the fears, get past the doubts. We all have the tools within us to make anything happen. It just starts right with your thinking, right with your thought process.
And I think one of the greatest things that cause fear is when you're worried about what somebody else is going to think about you. Success, leading, speaking, all the things that you talk about, when you really come down to it, at its base, it's, well, what are they going to think of me if I do this? What are they going to think of me if I do that? And if I'm successful, then I'm not really proving myself right about myself because I've been told I'm not worthy all my life. And we live our lives based on what someone else thinks. And it's very interesting when it's time to stop, it turns out, the life turns out completely different, even though the same things happen to you. It's, you meet somebody, you like somebody, and you don't want to let them know who you are. You want to let them know who they think you are. And that way you can put a mask on, and they're having a good time and you're miserable because you're hiding. That's what goes on in most relationships and life today.
Definitely. And all those fears that I talk about, fear of success, fear of leading, fear of speaking, fear of power, fear of inadequacy, those are all perceptions that you have of yourself. People won't step into leadership roles because they're scared to, what if I lead them the wrong way? Or I don't know how to do it and somebody's not going to like me, or somebody's going to see me and they're not going to approve of me. I might get rejected. That's all with your self-confidence and with worrying about what other people think. And worrying is definitely a syndrome that causes a lot of stress and disease and keeps you blocked from doing what you're really called to do. Pushing the fears out of the way, pushing the worry, pushing the judgment of yourself or what somebody else thinks out of the way. Who cares? I think that we're all given a gift and a talent that we're supposed to do while we're here on this planet. And these fears block us from doing that and the self-confidence. So it's really imperative that you work on your psyche, your self-talk, thoughts or things, what you think about, you bring about. So if you're thinking along the negative lines and worrying, you're going to attract that into your life.
And we're always so worried about what somebody else is going to think about the way we look, the way we feel. Okay, here comes the big example. Radio Susie's going to pass out again. Ask me, Eldonna, ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Are you good looking?
Funny you should ask. Absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. That's the key. I could have five women standing in front of me right now, and if I could possibly stand behind each one and look through their eyes to see me, I would see probably one or two good-looking Michael Rays, and the rest of them might think I'm the homeliest thing in the world. You can't please everybody. So you please the people you can please, and you let the others go about their life and their business and go have a good time. So am I good-looking? You bet, to the people who think I'm good-looking.
Exactly. I love it. That's perfect. But the person you most have to please, or actually the person that you have to love, is that person looking in the mirror back at you. If you can't love that person and really embrace the person that you see looking back at you, it doesn't matter whatever is going on outside in the world. It has to start with you. It has to start with you believing in yourself, you taking control of every part of your life. If you don't understand how to do something, asking somebody for the help to get the training, to get the understanding, to get the education to do it. It's all about starting with you, that person in the mirror looking back at you and saying, you know what, I love you. I don't care what anybody else says.
Absolutely, because somebody else is going to love you too, and if somebody doesn't, they're not, and there's nothing you can do about it. And what I learned a long time ago is an interesting lesson. I was standing in front of a workshop, and I was up on a chair, and I jumped up on the chair, and I looked at the people in the workshop, and I said, "Describe me." And I got everything from you loving the wonderful giving individual to you self-centered, egotistical son of a yada yada yada, right? And I said, "Oh, what are you talking about?" And they said, "You know," and I said, "Whoa, whoa, whoa. See, they were projecting. It had nothing to do with me." And the key is that when you first start talking to someone or when someone first meets you, 20% of the people that listen to you or see you, they're not going to like you. It could be your gender, your ethnicity, the sound of your voice, your subject matter, your something. And when it comes down to it, it's not you. They're seeing what they like or dislike in themselves. And we go through life getting rejected, becoming victims and everything else because if somebody doesn't like what they see in you, but it's really about them, when we can make that shift, the world turns around.
Exactly, and rejection's never personal. It's always about their stuff. Somebody comes up to you and you say, "Hey, you have $1,000," they say no. They're not rejecting you. They're just rejecting what they're able to provide you. Just like somebody goes and does a sales call and they're, "Oh, no, I'm not interested." That's not rejection. They're just not interested. And a lot of people have a fear of their own power, how powerful. We're powerful beings, and we all have the power to make our dreams come true and do whatever we put our minds to. And many people have the fear of that power, so they stay inhibited with themselves, and they hang on to that fear, and they shrink, and they're never fully who they are, and they're not expanding who they could be. So it's imperative to really understand that we are powerful beings, and we're powerful beyond what we can even comprehend. And we have the power to make anything happen in this world, including getting past all our fears.
Well, Donna, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, I do. I am at pinkbikerchick.com, spelled like chic, C-H-I-C, and also gopinkmagazine.com. Also on Twitter as pinkbikerchick, and you can catch me on Facebook as well.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for being here. And the comment, it's like my mom used to say to me all the time, "Go kick some posterior."
That's right. Go pink.
Okay. Good night.
Thanks.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Kambiz Mothisattu with us. He's an author. He's a California State University graduate, a business executive, and a consultant. And he's had over 20 years of entrepreneurial experience, dedicated time to philanthropic causes, his unique cosmopolitan background that induces love, that includes love for traveling and discovering new cultural experiences as depicted in this very unique style of writing. Now, his book is The 25 Principles of Martial Arts Strategy Book for Business and Life, the strategy book that uses the core principle of martial arts and adapts them to business and life. And Kambiz, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, by the way, did I pronounce your name properly?
Yes, you did.
Oh, okay. I wanted to make sure I got that. Okay. Kambiz, let me ask you this. Martial arts, define what martial arts, what are we dealing with when we talk about that realm, that world?
Martial arts is a system that was created by people who were under oppression historically, and that means everyone. The human race as an evolved people who are under oppression. It started with the first human being who looked at something and said, this is mine, and tried to protect it for himself and his family. Martial arts is the basis of self-defense. I usually say you can't get more political than defending your own body. I myself studied political science, but I believe the most political thing is being able to defend your own body, and martial arts is the system that allows you to defend yourself.
But isn't it also a process? Isn't it also a way of life? Things that you learn in the martial arts, and then you apply them to life, and you apply the principles to business, etc. So it's more than just defense. It's realistically a way of life and a process, a strategy to move you through business and move you through life and get what you want, because they believe it's very intentional. You don't just do something in martial arts. Obviously, everything becomes instinctive after a while, but it's a learned strategy, step by step by step, till you learn the moves and the rhythm and everything else that goes along with it.
Absolutely. Just like in life, there's no way to be able to specifically learn how to act in every situation we come across. But we live on principles. We're guided upon principles that we live on, and the same with martial arts. It has a set of principles, and these martial arts principles are the base from which strategy is created from. So, instead of, for example, in any situation, whether it's in business or a relationship, instead of taking a cookie cutter strategy and applying it, you would take the principles that you've already learned and be able to create a new strategy based on the situation, so it'll fit.
And absolutely, and move it through you, and move it through. And I think really that's the key, because when you deal with the martial arts, you deal with anything. Most of it becomes automatic, and I really believe when you say automatic, is that when you are dealing with business and you are dealing with life, if you have the strategy of life, you don't have to stop and think about it. You automatically move through. You know what to do now. Let me ask you the principle of formlessness. What are we talking about when we say that word?
Well, when we're talking about the principle of formlessness, is we're talking about not giving off signals or intentions that will give off that will reveal your hand, so to speak, or give away your advantage of surprise. You want to be able to always possess the advantage of surprise, because that's what helps you. Look at companies. They always talk about competitive advantage. You even have, companies like AT&T who, for example, own the rights to thousands of patents, but they might not even patent a lot of their inventions because they don't want to create opponents. So by revealing your hand, you lose the advantage of surprise, and that's what formlessness is about.
I think Sun Tzu said it many, many, many years ago. If you're strong, let your enemy think you're weak. And if you're weak, let your enemy think you're strong. And in that way, you totally control. I can't tell you how many business situations over the years that I've sat in, and those, before I opened my mouth, those words would stop me or move me forward.
Absolutely. One of the important things is to be able to hide your form to always retain the advantage, so you deny your opponents the opportunity of being able to assess your strengths and your weaknesses.
Now, the principle of shifting power.
The principle of shifting power says that no one can hold power indefinitely. By attempting to hold power, you end up becoming controlled by power. And it says that resources, besides resource creation, you really don't have creation of power. you have power that's shifted from one hand to another, because power in the end is a zero-sum game. One person wins at the expense of somebody else. So what you're having is you're having power being shifted and transferred, not necessarily power generated, unless new resources are being generated.
Okay, let me come up with an example and tell me if I'm close with what you're talking about with shifting power. There's an adage that I've lived by many, many years of my life, and it's this. A good leader knows when to follow, and a good teacher knows when to be a student. I change hats constantly. Isn't that also an example of shifting power?
It is. It is. But let's look at one of the principles, another one of the principles that I wrote about, the 24th principle of apprenticeship, which teaches us that there will always exist, to some extent, a hierarchy in education. And we need that hierarchy because that, to a large extent, creates the stability of the system in which we live in and prosper. But there's no way to really advance without becoming an apprentice of somebody who knows more than you.
Sure. And isn't that about life? You learn so much, and then you meet somebody who knows more, and you become the student, and then you get that, and then you've got it, and you're teaching it, and then all of a sudden you meet somebody who knows more than you, and you become the student again. Isn't that constant?
Absolutely it is. And let's look at an old case in martial arts, one of the most famous martial arts in the world, an Olympic sport, judo. Jigoro Kano, when he came up with the system of judo, he was an upstart amongst thousands of jiu-jitsu schools in Japan at that time. But at that time, they were going through a modernization period, so they wanted to advance their systems, and judo became the state sanctioned or official system. But he was an upstart, and when he came in, he was maybe 20, 30 years younger than these jiu-jitsu masters who've been practicing for maybe, you know, 30, 40 years of their life, and they ended up becoming students of someone who was 30, 40 years younger than they were, which was interesting.
Which tells you that they're wonderful teachers because they know. And I think that's really what it's about. It's you can't know everything, and there are people who can look over your shoulder and see what you don't see. And I think that's really some of the secrets of life. Okay, the principles of alliance.
The principles of alliance says that alliances are constantly shifting, and the reason why they're shifting is because they depend on human desires. Humans, each individual has their own wants and needs, and based on their own wants and needs, they may make temporary alliances so they can benefit, but what I advise is to make alliances with people stronger than yourself, and in doing that, you become stronger and you benefit. But on the flip side, if you end up making an alliance with someone weaker than yourself, that may weaken you, though you still may benefit.
Okay, and a great example of that is if you are, quote-unquote, an entrepreneur. There's so many entrepreneurs out there today that is sitting at your home, and you've got a business, and you've got your computer on the kitchen table, and that's where you're making money. Now, all of a sudden, you start to get more orders, you're making more money, you've got to hire people to augment your skills. So you hire people who know more than you do, because that in and of itself has got to be one of the principles of alliance. You hire people that can increase your ability and your impact on the world out there.
Absolutely. And look, it's natural for us as human beings not to want to let go, to want to do everything. And we feel by doing that we're establishing our domain over our belongings. But really, we need alliances, and because each individual can bring a strength to the table, and sometimes they can bring a weakness to the table, and that's why alliances have to be viewed with scrutiny before they're developed and, you know, taken forward.
Okay, touch on this. Fast loss, quick win.
Fast loss, quick win says that by attempting to win in an unwinnable situation, what you're doing is wasting resources. And by you're not creating any positive situation for yourself by trying to win an unwinnable situation. It's better to walk away. If you can't get a fast win, it's better to take a quick loss and walk away from that situation and live on to fight another day.
And that's also part of that is learning when to back off, when to retreat.
Absolutely. And that's one of the principles as well, the principle of retreating. A lot of times we view as a retreat as a loss or a lack of courage, or we weren't determined enough, or we didn't execute it properly enough. And it really has nothing to do with that. It's really having the correct combination of factors working together in order to win. And a lot of times you have all the wrong factors working together in order for you to lose, and you can't do anything about it. That's just how the situation is.
Okay. Now, by the way, one other thing, and then I'm going to break this down because I'm looking at this and I can see some interesting things here. Yielding, so critical.
Absolutely. Flexible. You want to be flexible. It's so easy to say, you know, I have to stand my ground and be rigid, and we want to win every battle. And that's natural as human beings. We want to win every situation. But it's very important to be able to yield. And yielding is different than retreating, because yielding, you're doing it in order to gain an advantage. And you're in effect almost using the energy of that force and becoming one with it in order to use it to your advantage. But unless you become one with it, you can't really become flexible enough to be able to make it yours. You have to be able to become one with it to be able to control it.
Okay, so now I'm in a business, and one of the things that I know in business is to keep the business in and of itself formless in a way that if a decision has to be made and has to recreate the way it's done, it can be done very rapidly. And I also know that in business, if we're concentrating on accounting, and that's not where to go, we have to be able to shift the power to another area of the business to be able to move forward. One of the biggest things in the business that we can have is the alliances, those relationships that we've created, and we have to make sure that they're the best thing we can possibly have. Also, we got to make sure that we don't get somebody to say, hey, you can make a lot of money here, because we can fall on our rear end. Fast loss, quick win. And when to back off and move another way. And when you want to negotiate, make sure that you know when to yield to gain. Are we close here?
Absolutely. And just to touch on that, the 14th principle of timing says that you can only advance when the opponent reveals an opening for you to advance. And if there's no gap for you to exploit, you're just going to waste resources.
You know what I think, which would be really good if you could talk to some of the business colleges, the schools, and get some of the principles within those business courses, because when you really come down to it, this is the bare essence of business. This is how a business should be run.
Absolutely. And these principles really are applicable and are applicable in business, and they're applicable in your personal life and personal relationships as well.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. What was it, and I want to go backwards now, but what was it that got you involved in this in the first place? What made you think of life the way you've written it?
Well, I studied martial arts pretty much my whole life. Since I was 6 years old, I started practicing taekwondo, and I went on to practicing karate and boxing and wrestling and jiu-jitsu. And I fell in love with martial arts as a child. And then when I grew in age, I realized that, you know, sometimes you get to tone down the creativity a little, but you get to increase your scholarship level and get to really read about the great and vast literature that's out there, especially from Asia. You look at Art of War, you look at Hagakure, you look at the seven military classics of ancient China. There's really great books out there that share the ancient knowledge and how it existed. But a lot of times it's so long-winded, and it's almost like a riddle, and it's not broken down as easy as it's explained in a book like The 25 Principles of Martial Arts, which is pretty straightforward, and almost each line is a important sentence that contains wisdom of the ages, and that's what's important. It's direct and straightforward and concise.
No, I hear you loud and clear. And most people today, and when I say this respectfully to everybody, if there's an area that you're going to get into and you don't know everything you need to know about that area, you need somebody, quote-unquote, looking over your shoulder, bringing the invisible up to the table, or symbolically holding your hand and getting you through it until you've mastered it yourself. By the way, I think the principles are great. Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Absolutely. You can buy the book on Amazon.com. And it's you can buy it in two ways. If you're an Amazon Kindle user, or if you're not, you can get the Amazon Kindle app as well. For the next 3 months, I will be providing for Kindle users who are also Amazon Prime members. They can read the 25 Principles of Martial Arts without paying anything. And if they're interested, they can purchase it. And if they would like to purchase the print version, it's $8.88 on Amazon.com.
Wonderful. Hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. Bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Catherine Toll with us. She's the author of The Next Bold Step, Learning to Love and Value Yourself and Know That You Matter. Very important words. She's a licensed marriage family therapist, university educator, speaker, and a consultant. In her private practice in Los Angeles, she's known for her dynamic work with individuals, couples, adolescents, and families. She brings a richness of personal and professional experience with a specific interest in trauma-focused treatment. She's a published author and a poet, a certified provider of continuing education with the State of California Board of Behavioral Sciences. And let us say, Catherine, I welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael. Hi.
Oh, hi, and thank you so much for being here. You know what? The tagline, I think the last couple of words, Catherine, are so powerful, and know that you matter. I wonder how many people out there would not admit it, but really don't think that they matter, and that's where a lot of the problems stem from.
Exactly, and that's exactly what I discovered, and that's why I decided that that had to be included in the title of the book.
Yeah, and how do you get them, and I know this is a very simple question and the answer is a little more complex, but how do you get someone to realize when they look in the mirror that they matter? You know, you can look at yourself and say, you matter.
Well, it sounds like a simple question, Michael, but it actually is very complex. And truthfully, it takes some very compassionate and some tender but powerful work to help somebody be able to navigate their way through all of the really successful mechanisms that they've built over a lifetime to pretend that they're happy and pretend that they feel good and pretend that their life is fulfilling. But underneath that, there really is a current that they feel like they don't matter. And it can take quite a while for somebody to be willing to be vulnerable enough to admit that.
You know, you talk about restoring happiness, fulfillment, success. You know, there's a lot of people who have never experienced what it is in the first place, and it's not restoring it, it's the creation of it sometimes. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not in there. I think what happens is we bury it, you know, we defend it, we don't recognize it anymore. But it's not something that you learn to do. You learn to open it up. But the most important thing is it's there, but it's the creation of it so you can live it.
Exactly so. And
yeah.
One of the things that I try to do in the book is I try to also educate people to understand how they got to where they're at in the first place. Because as hard as it is to admit, for someone to admit, you know, I guess I feel like I really don't matter, then they feel really ashamed because they feel like, well, for heaven's sakes, I'm a grown-up. I should feel better than this. They feel really ashamed about their feelings and confused, and it can really help for them to understand how their belief system got created in the first place. Because what I discovered is that it, as you said, the happiness is actually there. It is innate in every human being. At least that's my belief. But
by the way, it's two of us that believe that.
Oh, good. It gets so covered up by experience.
Sure.
That it helps to have an education about how the internal belief system is created that buries the happiness so powerfully.
No, absolutely. And we defend ourselves. If something looks like something that happened in the past, we don't even think it's not even conscious. And we defend ourselves in the battles and the fights and the rest of it, and the depression starts because we end up protecting ourselves. And what we do is we protect ourselves. And if I repeat this 5,000 times a day, I should repeat it 12,000 times a day. We go through life proving ourselves right about ourselves. The belief system causes us to learn a particular thing. You have an experience. The experience causes a belief. The belief triggers an emotion. The emotion triggers how you think, act, and respond to the world around you. And once that's stuck, unless you know how to change it, there's problems there.
Exactly. It's exactly the case. And in the book, what I've been helping people do is learn to understand exactly what you just so succinctly explained, but also to internalize that at a pretty profound level, and then learn how to undo that, and I call it deconstruction. You have to learn how to deconstruct that process so that you can reconstruct the thought system and the belief system that actually supports your happiness.
No question about it. And it's most people, I was going to say us, I'm a human being, sometimes, don't tell anybody, but most people are living what they went through 20, 30, 40 years ago, and they're not even aware of it. You walk into a room, somebody smiles at you, oh, it's that smile. And you're not even thinking about it. It's just that momentary recognition of something that you didn't like in the past, and now the defense is there.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You're very sophisticated about this.
Well, the radio Susie's over there smiling. She says, go get some dopamine, you'll feel better. But when it really comes down to it, that's the way our life works. And I'm going to get back to something this word calls simple. If you begin to understand it, all of a sudden life completely changes for you. You don't respond or react the way you did 5 minutes ago.
Well, I'm just going to differ with you a little bit in the fact that my experience has demonstrated that it actually takes a lot of practice, that understanding it is the first and most important step, because without the understanding, you're kind of just shooting in the dark. But once you have the understanding, remember that you have a lifetime of an embedded pattern. And your mind is going to continue to follow that pattern over and over and over again. And so just like working out any muscle, you have to be very conscious and very mindful to work out the muscle of control that you have about what you think. And the more you practice it, then it begins to become your new pattern. Otherwise, the old pattern just stays in place.
You know what I used to do when something would bother me, and I knew when I knew about the behavior, etc. what I used to do is something would bother me, and I start thinking about a puppy, and I would absolutely make myself get soft and smile, and everything was the same, yet the reaction and response was completely different.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's true, and that was a very conscious decision on your part to do that.
But isn't that what it, and this is a question now, isn't that what it has to be, a conscious decision to do that? There are so many people today that they don't have identity. They're not accepted in so many different areas. And because they don't have that identity, they're going to find a way to get accepted or get attention paid to them. And it could be they're depressed all the time. They're angry all the time. They lose all the time. They can't stay in a relationship all the time. And this in and of itself is their way to say, look at me.
Yes. Yes, it's true. And it is the conscious choice that you want to feel differently and you want your life to look differently, and then you're willing to do what it takes to make that happen.
No, absolutely. Now, let me ask you this. Where did it start for you? Something had to trigger you to move into this area.
Well, it started with having survived a life-threatening trauma myself in December of 1999. And it wasn't until that moment in time when everything turned upside down and everything came crashing down and I had to start a long and arduous process of literally getting to know myself again and rebuilding an entire life for myself and my three kids.
Mm.
And that then kind of plunged me into a lot of very deep self-work, because the choices that I had been making had led me to a place that ended up being very, very dark. And I had to start learning why I was making those kinds of choices and how to make different choices, and that all of that said everything about me. So I really had to begin to take a look at myself and decide, is this what I want my life to say about me? Or do I want my life to say something different?
Now, by the way, did you lose your self-esteem?
Hugely.
Okay.
Absolutely, well, hugely. And the other thing that I have discovered over the last decade, Michael, as I've been doing this work and developing this aspect of my professional life, is that self-esteem, of course, is a lifelong evolutionary process, and yet along that path, at certain developmental times in life, for example, in very early childhood, and then again in the elementary school years, then again in middle school, then again in high school, then again in college and in young adulthood, and in relationship to your primary partner, which in my life turned out to be first one husband and then a second husband. Those primary relationships, first with my family, with my parents and my sibling, then my peers, then my partners, those primary relationships had everything to do with who I thought I was and how much I felt appreciated and acknowledged in the world. And it was through those experiences that my sense of self-value was created. And what I have discovered working with hundreds and hundreds of people at this point is that it's exactly the same process that everyone goes through.
Now, by the way, I think an important sentence was who you thought you were. When it came down to it, and you did the work that you did, and you peeled away the facades and got down to Catherine, did you find another person there? Did you find who you really were as opposed to what you were showing the world, what you're like?
What I found was that the person that I frequently actually showed the world and felt was a bit of a facade, who she is beautiful and articulate and talented and professional and very pulled together and people really like her, that person on the outside is actually who I am, but my head didn't agree with it. My head inside, the conversation that I was having was that I was this fat little kid who didn't fit in, whose grades weren't quite good enough, you know, who never quite entirely measured up to the bar, who wasn't in the popular group, who didn't get into her college of first choice, et cetera, et cetera. All those messages that we get in a lifetime that say to you, you know, kid, you're really not good enough. That was what the messages in my head were telling me, even though the woman that I developed into on the outside looked great and sounded really great. So I've been on a process of integration, recognizing that I really am that terrific woman that I was able to put out there, but I hadn't believed in her. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Something came up, I don't like to do the same thing in the same night, but I'm gonna do it anyway because it's just apropos for what you're talking about. It's that beautiful woman that you are. You're going to be beautiful to somebody who thinks you're beautiful. The people who don't think you're beautiful, you will never be beautiful to. So in essence, when you know you are, then you acknowledge and accept the people who think you are. Let's do this. Let's try this. Ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead.
Michael, are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that. Okay, absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. Got it. You know, and if I had, that's the example, but if I had five women standing in front of me right now, and if I had the ability, Catherine, to get behind each one, look at their eyes to see me, you know, somebody would think I'm absolutely gorgeous. Somebody else is going to think I'm homely, and somebody else could go, you know, oh yeah, right. So you can't please everybody. And at my optimal best, I can only be the second best you. Perfection, the highest form of function, is fine as long as it's your perfection and not what somebody else thinks you should be like, because you're never going to get there.
Exactly. And yet, how many people do you know who were actually taught that the only person's opinion that mattered was their own?
Nobody.
Precisely the point.
Got it. No, absolutely. I mean, I wish I could have said I was this way at 4 months old, but it took a couple of years. But you're right. It's all about acceptance, and it's all about, I think where the real shift comes from is you have to give yourself permission. Everybody needs permission. We just don't seem to be able to do it on our own. So you have to give yourself permission to be who you want to be.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I got it. Loud and
clear. A lot of work to get there, because most people have been taught that permission and acceptance and happiness lie outside of them.
Yeah.
When the truth is that all of that lies inside of you.
And all of this are steps to identity. Everybody struggles for identity. We want identity. And, you know, the people who accept us, so we identify with them. You take a kid. If the family isn't doing what the family is supposed to do, whatever that is, the kid goes out for acceptance. If it happens to be a gang, it's accepted. There's identity. Look at what Hitler did during the Second World War. Germany was going through some economic turmoil. They didn't know who they were. They were confused. He was brilliant. I happen to be Jewish, so I'm not too excited about Hitler. But at the same time, he was brilliant in what he did. He gave them identity.
Yeah.
Here's a brown shirt. Here's an emblem. You're part of the gang now. And they killed for that. And it's very important. We've got to realize that we do strive for identity. And parents, if they understand that, may take a second look at how they deal with their kids.
And the world would be a better place when that happens.
I totally agree. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book and get more information about you?
You bet. And it's very easy to remember. It's nextboldstep.com. So just like the title of the book, the nextboldstep.com.
And you have to have a little tagline there. It's only for pretty people.
Not, because everybody is pretty on the inside.
That's it,
you
yes.
just look deeply enough.
Catherine, hey, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
With you
again. But now the curtain falls.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
these dusty walls. People say I was made for this. Nothing else would I trade for this.
Dun, 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 dun.